Episode 8, Part 2. First person plural pronouns and you. Critical thinking question. First, suppose you live in a neighborhood controlled by a violent gang. For some strange reason, when you talk about this violent gang and their activities, you use pronouns, first-person pronouns like we, us, and our, when describing their activities. Even though you're not in the gang, you don't know anyone in the gang, no one in the gang knows you or cares about you. Is it safe to assume that over time, this linguistic programming might lead you to develop sympathy for the gang's activities and resistance to the idea that the individuals in this gang are even doing anything wrong? What if everybody in the neighborhood did this? What would that mean for the legitimacy of the gang?
Consonants and vowels, the consequence of sounds, the consonants and vowels, the consequence of sound.
In 1938, Ayn Rand wrote a novelette called Anthem. As one reads through this short book, they will probably notice that one of the most common words in the English language is eerily absent. That word is I, a word representative of the individual. Anthem is set in a dystopic future, even though a specific date is never given, where, as the main character describes, we are nothing, mankind is all. By the grace of our brothers, we are allowed our lives. We exist through, by, and for our brothers, who are the state. Amen. The setting of Anthem, this futuristic dark age, has resulted from long periods of irrationality and collectivistic thinking, as well as central planning over society, and in Anthem, individuality is virtually non-existent. Things like technological advancement are centrally managed. The main character in Anthem realizes these problems and flees the society. He eventually realizes, quote, "At first, man was enslaved by the gods, but he broke the chains. Then he was enslaved by the kings, but he broke the chains. He was enslaved by his birth, by his kin, by his race, but he broke their chains. He declared to all his brothers that man has rights which neither God nor king nor other men can take away from him, no matter what their number, for his is the right of men, and there is no right on earth above this right. And he stood on the threshold of freedom for which the blood of centuries behind him had been spilled. But then he gave up all he had won and fell lower than his savage beginning. What brought it to pass? What disaster took their reason away from men? What whip lashed them to their knees in shame and submission? The worship of the word we." So Anthem was one of Rand's earliest attempts to address this dichotomy between individualism and collectivism. Collectivism, which is basically, as she would put it, the subjugation of the individual to the group. Many of the ideas presented in Anthem were better fleshed out in her later work, both fiction and nonfiction. But it's still a very interesting and very haunting read, maybe even more haunting than the Smurfs. Now, I don't want School Sucks Podcast to turn into some kind of Ayn Randathon, and I am certainly not what some people might call a Randroid. There's a big difference between scholarship of a person and worship of a person. And I think, you know, especially recently, we all have a pretty good idea of what worship looks like.
Oh, Obama. Shh. He's on television. He's talking. We must listen so we can learn how to follow him better. Oh, do not ask questions. Your incredulity displeases him.
And scholarship would be the ability to discern what a person got right or what a person did really well from some of the places or some of the areas or some of the ideas where they kind of dropped the ball philosophically or as far as consistency is concerned. So one of the most knowledgeable people that I know or that I've heard speak on the subject is my friend, one of my actually closest and dearest friends in that group of friends that I've never actually met face-to-face or shaken hands with, the online ones. Wes Bertrand is one of the most knowledgeable people that I've heard speak about Ayn Rand's work. And some of Rand's best work is on this topic of collectivism, which is what we're going to talk about today. In fact, to find somebody who knew more about Rand's work, I'd probably actually have to go talk to somebody at the Ayn Rand Institute. But, you know, on that path to complete personal and political freedom, where everybody at the Ayn Rand Institute falls flat on their face after stumbling over the roots of some hideous overgrown tree, I'd rather find somebody who keeps striding forward to a conclusion that is consistent with Rand's objectivist ideas, a feat that even she was not able to pull off in her lifetime. And Wes is someone, among many others, who has been able to do that. So today we're going to talk not only about Rand's work on collectivism, but collectivism in general, and the kind of conformity training that must be foisted upon the individual to make large-scale collectivism in society possible. And like the main character in Ayn Rand's novelette Anthem, we will also explore the dangers, the pitfalls, and the destructiveness of using first-person plural pronouns like we to describe groups that we could never be a part of and actions that in our own lives we would find completely deplorable. And we would be embarrassed if we ever carried these things out ourselves. How would you feel if you vaporized 100,000 Japanese civilians? How would you feel if you had slaves? How would you feel if you carpet-bombed Cambodia? We did not do these things. But that use of the word we makes too many people feel like it's okay that these things were done. So anyway, today is part one of two of this discussion between Wes and I. The next episode will include the conclusion.
Did you know that the grave digger still get you stuck in the machine, even though it's a whole other daydream? It's another town, it's another world where the kids are asleep and the loans are paid and the lawns are mowed. What'd you think? All the grave diggers were gone. Just 'cause one song is done, there's always another one waiting right around the bend till this one ends. Then it begins squeaky clean and it starts all over again. The weather report keeps on tossing and turning, predicting and warning and warning and warning of possible leakage from news.
I'm being joined by Wes Bertrand, the host of Complete Liberty Podcast, the author of the books The Psychology of Liberty and Complete Liberty, The Demise of the State and the Rise of Voluntary America. And Wes, I'm thinking that you're probably going to have a couple of new things that you'd want to mention as well. But today we're going to be talking about conformity and how that scales up in the adult society to this meme of collectivism. How are you doing, Wes?
I'm doing great, Brett. Doing really well. I'm glad to have the chance to be on your show now. You've been on my show multiple times, and thanks for that. And it's great to talk about this because it is a huge subject about essentially psychology and philosophy in our culture. Conformity actually is defined as compliance with standards, rules, or laws, behavior in accordance with socially accepted conventions or standards. We are taught that in school, are we not, as we go up through the grades? Whether you're in a public school or a private school, it seems to be a consistent message that you have to conform to standards, rules, and laws, and oftentimes in defiance of what is rational, what is moral, and what is just, as you've pointed out in multiple podcasts previously.
And I think the way that I had dealt with this subject in the past on my show was elementary school seemed to be very, very much about pounding home the idea of obedience, the obedience training. Now, obviously, this conformity, as far as conformity to standards, conformity to expectations, conformity to groups, exists throughout primary school. It really, really ramps up when we get to middle school and ultimately to high school, where we have what I talked about in the last episode, the pressure to fit in, the pressure really not to stick out, to get yourself into some kind of clique. And I've been talking to a lot of kids over the last couple of weeks just about what's going on in high school today. I obviously, being in close proximity to where I grew up here in New Hampshire, I do meet a lot of kids who go to Exeter High School, where I went to high school. So I'm, you know, is it still the same? And all, it's all the same cliques, all the same messages in the classroom, all the same homework assignments. It's amazing what hasn't changed in the last 12 or 13 years. So the question that I was thinking about for today, like I said, is we have this training in conformity. And what I wanted to discuss was the scaling up to this collectivism that is so pervasive in society.
Yeah, the collectivism of politics, essentially. And of course, there are different facets to collectivism. It takes groups of people to accomplish certain ends, whether it's in a business or it's on a playing field in sports or a community. But the kind of collectivism that we talk about is one that involves tools of coercion, right? And threats. If you obey, if you step out of line, if you're a nonconformist. And at the very least in school, if you're a nonconformist, that's really frowned upon. Maybe you're sent to detention or you're just cast out of the group as some kind of freak or misfit, or sent to one of those alternative schools. I remember I had to do a little bit of counseling in my practicum with kids that had not done the right things in the regular schools. These were the down and out kids, and they were in the alternative schools. And there's a definite message that's sent to those people, right, that don't conform. And unfortunately, the adults in our world don't do a lot to analyze why it is that one would not want to conform to the present system. Like, they accept the status quo for what it is, and they don't really question why we have the things that we have in education, why we do it this way.
No, and really, even in school, as far as adults are concerned, the teachers are just the conduits that deliver it from the past generation to the next generation, that same message. And, you know, too, on what you were saying there, I cut my teeth in education at an alternative school. It was a boarding school, and they prided themselves, the administration at the school, as enrolling the most difficult children on the East Coast as far as social, emotional, and behavioral problems were concerned. And I spent my first 4 years working with kids, two sort of in other roles doing like team building adventure type stuff, and the other two as a teacher. And I found these kids to be absolutely great because they, you know, certainly they were what was called oppositional defiant. I'm sure you're familiar with
sure.
that term.
Exactly.
But really to have started my career working with kids like that and then going into tutoring where, you know, the children are mainstream and able to just sort of march themselves through that conforming routine lockstep of public education. I missed those kids because they were the ones who had the questions and they were the ones who could really see your BS. And obviously when I started and I was younger and I was much more of, I would even say, an authoritarian as far as my approach to how I dealt with young people, they could see right. I was filled with a lot more BS than I am today, and they could see right through it, and they would call you on it. And you miss that because a lot of times when you're working with kids who aren't labeled as, you know, oppositionally defiant, you're just kind of looking at blank stares, and they're just... And I'm generalizing a little bit, but it's sort of like they're just more willing to absorb without question whatever the message is. And that's how you get labeled in public education as non-defective, if you will mm-hmm. just sort of sponge up the authoritarian message. You know what I mean?
Sure. And there are very there are psychological payoffs for conforming, for not questioning the so-called authority. And that's one thing that kids are encouraged to do in our society today, that teachers are supposed to be the ones that have the answers or at least know what questions to ask of the students. And then the students are supposed to go on this fact-finding mission or searching in themselves to find the answers, rather than the students asking the teacher questions and the teacher being providing a service to those students. So it seems like the whole system is inverted in terms of learning, but that's reflected in society at large, is it not, with regard to the politicians and the bureaucrats and the laws that are handed down to the so-called citizens to obey, to unquestioningly obey. And of course, they can use what you call that magic soap to engage in the process by which to change these laws that they're supposed to obey. Somehow the laws, once they're stricken, are no longer worth obeying anymore, because obviously they weren't based on any semblance of rational or moral principles that are consistent with an individual's functioning in reality. They're more consistent with what those in power or those in charge want the group to do. And that's kind of the perspective that most teachers take with students. How do we get this group to be managed properly? You know, the classroom management thing. I remember in the last show or a couple of shows you did previously that talked about that, that clip from, was it the 1950s, about how to be quiet?
Yes,
in class?
It's called I think it was called The Importance of Being Quiet in School from 1953. And just on that note, if anybody is interested in some hilarious YouTube videos that were not intended to be completely hilarious, do a search for Coronet, C-O-R-O-N-E-T films. These look like films that were, because of their length, I don't think that they were on television, and because of some of the dates, I'm thinking it was before most people had televisions, like 47, 49, 51. So I'm guessing they just played on short reels before movies that a lot of teenagers in the 40s and 50s would attend. And they are really hilarious. You know, homosexual, he's got reefer, what do you do? Find an adult. That was one of my favorites. But the ones that are about school are, at the same time, while they're amusing, they're also very haunting, because the people who had messages like those imposed on them taught us. So now, hopefully, since we, our generation, is a little bit more resistant to such blatant bombardments of intellectual insults, that there's even more hope for the generation that follows. And I've said to you before a couple of times that I see the people coming through high school now as the people who will really push this complete liberty idea forward. But that was a small tangent. So you were saying the classroom management in the 1950s. I'm sorry, Wes.
Well, that's just, you know, it fits right in with the mentality of educators today, because they are basically teaching what they learned, right? Mm-hmm. And they learned not to question so-called authority. I say so-called authority because when we talk about authority, that is a term that must be questioned, because this whole process of learning to be an individual, of individuating from the tribe, the group, the collective, is a process of nonconformity, in the sense that you are your own guide in this process called life, and you're in charge. If you're not in charge, then someone else is presuming to be in charge of you, which may question, well, who's in charge of their process? So as Ayn Rand said, life is a process of self-generated and self-sustaining action, of self-regulation, if you will. And there's one thing that modern education does not do. It doesn't teach people to be self-regulated, to be self-governed. It teaches people to be governed by other people who supposedly can't govern themselves either. Well, maybe they can, because they are the so-called authorities. And how does one become an authority in this process? Is it just by learning what other people taught? Or is it by independently thinking about things and becoming an expert on a certain subject that you have a lot of skill in and a lot of knowledge to impart to other people? Because as Ayn Rand said once again, you know, people have two things to offer each other in society, knowledge and trade. And that can only be done in a society in which people are respected as individuals, rather than as members of a group that just must conform to what other people say or what a select group of people says. So I guess, in relation to the conformity meme, in order for us to really get to the bottom of it and to actually subvert this idea in our society that it's good to conform. A person really has to recognize their own self-esteem, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, another thing that she, a word that she used when she was talking about collectivism, just so we're clear with everybody on what we mean by that word, is antithetical to individualism, which I've already talked about, but she said the subjugation of the individual to the group. And you really see the connection both in conformity and then on a larger societal scale, how one just rolls right into the other so nice and neat. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes, conformity is required for collectivism to be as pervasive as it is today. And, of course, the dominant form of collectivism that we have that exercises coercion on people is statism. And that is in line with modern politics, in which people that call themselves government, and this has been a process of indoctrination too, because they learned that the idea of government is something that you should hold as sacrosanct and not question, because people need to be governed, Brett. If they're not governed, then who governs them?
Right.
But meanwhile, who governs the governors, right?
Well,
but you're not supposed to question that thing, are you? You're not supposed to question the meaning of these terms. You're just supposed to accept them and then proceed to go about your business as a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen.
Indeed. So this is why that this lesson of education, conformity, and how it translates to collectivism is just the logical next piece of this structure to be built on top of a foundation of obedience. Now, what would those people say was governing them, the people who claim to be the governors? They would say that they are just servants trying to ensure, here comes, the common good. And another thing that I remember Ayn Rand saying, and I'm paraphrasing her at this point, but that she pointed out that we often think about tyrants, Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, as evil people. And certainly they were, but there wasn't, they weren't James Bond villains. They attained legitimacy over their populations by claiming, as Rand pointed out, to be representatives of the common good. So that's always the trick. It's always been the same as far back as you want to go. As soon as the visible structures of violence had to disappear from any society, just because when societies were that oppressed, they had such a finite life, it would just be a matter of time before the people who were subject to that visible violence would rebel. So you invent this overarching idea of the common good, where everything that, sure, when you use reason and your five senses to evaluate, might look bad, but it's just the means that are so necessary to get to this common good. It's never like a question either of like, well, how many smaller goods need to be sacrificed or oppressed or killed or robbed to achieve this greater good? But, I mean, you would agree, Wes, that that is the trick of the ages right there, ascribing whatever kind of horrendous and violent and vile act to this allegiance that leaders supposedly have to this illusory common good, right?
Mm-hmm. And of course, most people today in America will say, "Oh, yeah, totalitarianism, dictatorships, you know, Stalin's Russia, Hitler's Germany, all these different facets of just complete tyranny are not what we have in America. What we have in America is a voice of the people, right? What did they call that? Vox populi?
Yep.
And that is supposedly a way to minimize or to ignore or deny the fundamental nature of what's going on in terms of political collectivism. Because none of these figureheads, the Hitlers, the Stalins, the Maos, the Obamas, would have any clout if they didn't have a whole collective of conformists to do what the figurehead says or what the figurehead wants people to do or the policies that they set. And it's amazing the amount of indoctrination that we have in America, even though supposedly it was an individualistic sort of political framework. People say that it's a constitutional republic, as if that is supposed to make the amount of collectivism that we see today somehow less than what it is or not really that important. But in fact, a constitutional republic can be just as oppressive when people don't conform. You see, once you have mass conformity, a system of statism can slide pretty quickly from fairly lenient sort of laws to somewhat draconian and then very totalitarian laws. And the only way it goes down that path is through blind obedience to authority and this mass conformity, which, you know, plays right into the hands of those in power who supposedly see some reason for doing this. But in the end, they're not benefiting themselves because they're denying who they are as individuals. They're part of the collective too. You know, they're sacrificing other people for the sake of themselves. They're not living for their own sake. They're not being independent. And they're sure not being disobedient. You know, they're conforming just as much as the people that are supposedly under them. You know, it's a two-way sort of binding process that happens with this conformity, because a master needs slaves, slaves need a master. If one side decides not to play that game, then the system is disrupted, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I've tried to maybe talk about that whole issue that you presented in simpler terms, there is on the one hand complete liberty, there is a stateless society, there is voluntarism. And then on the other hand, there are different degrees of totalitarianism, you know, going from what's sort of soft or less palpable to the point that you would get with, you know, communist China or Stalinist Russia. And I point that out because totalitarianism is one of those buzzwords that really gets the people that I talk to a little bit red in the face. When you talk about America in the same sentence with totalitarianism, that's upsetting. Communism is another one of those words. Like, I swear that one time I think the most upset I ever saw somebody is when I asked why America fought the idea of communism with industry that had been communized, meaning the military, an entirely communized organization, completely publicly funded, no competition. And a plume of smoke came out of this person's ear. They could not believe that I would conflate the American military with communism. So totalitarianism is another one of those words that people just don't have a very high tolerance for when you're talking about America. They think that that is an absolutely ridiculous statement. But it's a difference of degrees, and it's always, you know, just to continue that metaphor, it's always kind of getting hotter in the direction of totalitarianism as long as the longer the state goes on, and the more those memes of obedience and conformity are passed from generation to generation. It gets worse, certainly every clip of a few years.
Yeah, and do you think that the ethics of self-sacrifice is one of the dominant factors in conformity?
Yeah, I think it is perhaps the most important. I mean, there you need to have that idea firmly ingrained before anything else, certainly in the larger scale of the adult society that we live in, makes sense. Now, obviously, there's variance within that, because people would say, well, I have all kinds of control over my own life and I make my own decisions and I'm not sacrificing myself. And a lot of people would even go as far to say, as I do everything with, as far as how I interface with the state or how I interface with my government, I'm happy to do that. I would do more if they asked. Certainly that out of the other side of the mouth, it's all complaints about, you know, a lot of the things that the government is currently doing, but that conformity mean, that self-sacrifice idea is so firmly ingrained that even though in one instance they'll say they'll voice all these complaints, when I say, okay, well, that's great, we're off to a good start, maybe I can just pull you a little bit closer to my ideas, building on top of that, they just immediately withdraw and they're back to whatever is asked of me, my country, common good. They just revert back to that instantaneously as soon as you try to take them that next step.
Mm-hmm. Because they're in a psychological framework that precludes that level of awareness of themselves, their own autonomy, the potential autonomy, their own ability to make their own choices that are contrary to what other people are saying. I mean, it really boils down to, do you have the right to be a nonconformist? And if you were to ask people that, I wonder what the general consensus would be. I suppose it would vary according to which sort of subject you're talking about, but it basically raises the question of what are you conforming to and why is nonconformity important? And I just came across a couple of choice nuggets here on the Ayn Rand lexicon talking about collectivism. One is from the Objectivist newsletter back in 1969. In an essay titled Nazism and – is it Nazism or Nazism?
I like Nazism. That's what I've usually used.
Yeah. This is spelled Nazism. But let's say Nazism and reason – Nazism versus reason. And Ayn Rand wrote, "The philosophy of collectivism upholds the existence of a mystic and unperceivable social organism while denying the reality of perceived individuals, a view which implies that man's senses are not a valid instrument for perceiving reality. Collectivism maintains that an elite endowed with special mystic insight should rule men, which implies the existence of an elite source of knowledge, a fund of revelations inaccessible to logic and transcending the mind. Collectivism denies that men should deal with one another by voluntary means, settling their disputes by a process of rational persuasion. It declares that men should live under the reign of physical force, as wielded by the dictator of the omnipotent state, a position which jettisons reason as the guide and arbiter of human relationships. From every aspect, the theory of collectivism points to the same conclusion. Collectivism and the advocacy of reason are philosophically antithetical. It is one or the other." And there's actually another great quote right underneath that from the Objectivist newsletter in 1962, titled, "Who Will Protect Us from Our Protectors?" "The political philosophy of collectivism is based on a view of man as a congenital incompetent, a helpless, mindless creature who must be fooled and ruled by a special elite with some unspecified claim to superior wisdom and a lust for power." Well, that's packed with all kinds of choice nuggets, isn't it, Brett?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this too. Why or where or how do you think that people learn to use words like we and us and our when they're describing these individuals, these complete strangers who are exercising this power over them? I would think that that's definitely something that's picked up in school, but What do you think of that process? Because that's so common, and people have told me that when they say we're in Afghanistan or we dropped an atomic bomb on Japan, my question of what do you mean by we is brushed off as being semantics. So why do you think that that's so pervasive? Why do you think that that's so common that people do that, that they're just sort of programmed to speak that way?
Yeah, and it's not just people who are not so big fans of liberty. It's actually libertarians a lot of the time use these collectivistic pronouns and the possessive ones, our government or my government, these sorts of things, because it is part of our culture, it seems. And it does originate from, I think, the way the educational system is set up with classes, that we are part of a group and we march in lockstep. We go when the bells ring. And we do all these things as a group, and especially of a certain age category. You know, nowhere in society do you see people organize themselves according to their age, that I can tell. And that was one of the interesting insights made by Daniel Greenberg in the Sudbury Valley School Experience book. I think that if you look at a new way of educating people, or a new way that people can educate themselves, rather, because the process of learning is an individual process. It is an individual coming to terms with concepts and ideas and behaviors and different models and all kinds of input from the environment and in their own heads. All this process is an individual process. And you can get together with groups of people and achieve certain tasks and work on projects and so forth. But it all boils down to making your own choices. And that's the brilliant thing about, you know, free schools, which means that kids are there because they want to be there and they're learning what they want to learn, when they want to learn it, and how they want to learn it. And they are the ones that ask questions and look for resources, and the adults are there to provide resources for them. So in that process, there's no real idea of us or we in the sense that everyone has to march lockstep in that process, because it's almost as if the unschooling model or just intrinsic motivation, self-directed learning, puts an end to that collectivism sort of meme in people's heads that says, you know, we're all roped into this collective coercively, right? And we're all encouraged to be a central planner. And I think a lot of the talk about the plural pronouns and the collectivistic pronouns are used because they see this in the media. You turn on the television and everyone's talking about how to be a central planner. What policy do you want to have? What do you think should be done with this foreign military? Or, you know, it's just the grandest scale. And it's almost just a farce, isn't it? I mean, to look at the way that people talk about these collectivistic notions, it's as if they're not even connected with everyday experiences anymore. It's almost a form of mysticism, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good point, that is just so common in the media. And really what Jonathan Kozol, an author that I had talked about in an earlier episode, how he explained this happening in school was conformity as obedience to the status quo and finding your place basically within the preservation of it. And the other thing, too, is that you're absolutely right. We are all encouraged to think like these central planners, and maybe that makes us sympathetic to them in a way that, in addition to the other nonsense like the voting process and democracy, we call them us, or we call us them. And mm-hmm.
Frederick Mann would call that slave speak. He has that great article, The Anatomy of Slave Speak. And it's these memes, these political memes that we have in our head that's really keeping us enslaved.
Well, yeah. And the worst example of that I think I've ever heard is when I make some complaints and someone will say, well, don't you understand? You are the government. Kind of like telling a slave that, don't you see what's going on here? You are the whip, you are the manacles, you are the plantation. It would kind of be intellectually insulting to them. So I think that that's part of my reasoning for the idea that education is such a big part of it, that we get that neurolinguistic programming there first.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because we subconsciously get the message. I think John Taylor Gatto talks about this, about these hidden messages that are sent. Like the most important messages that are sent in education are the ones that are never really spoken, right? And they're the ones that are the most damaging because they do train masses of people just to be conformists and to not question authority, to not ask the question why, you know? Ask why do we have to do it this way? And because I said so isn't really a rational answer, is it?
No.
And I guess when you ask why and you don't get a responsive answer, what is that called in courts? A responsive answer? Is that what it's called?
Perhaps. I'll take your word for it.
The answer was non-responsive. And Mark Stevens talks about that when he questions witnesses on the stand. When they assert just an opinion, that's non-responsive answer. It's not based on evidence or facts. So to go down that path of questioning why – why do it this way? Why this way? Is a process of using your own mind, using your rational faculty of honoring yourself to understand things and to not just go along to get along, but rather do it because it is rational. It is moral to do things in a certain way. So in a sense, the whole process of conformity isn't honoring our rational faculties. It's honoring our ability to just jump through hoops, to not really be a conceptual creature anymore, but just be a follower. And that's not a place of strength, a place of courage or confidence. It's just a place of probably just mild depression and apathy for most people. And then, of course, as we started out talking about, the rebellious people, the oppositional defiant people who are willing to question authority, but oftentimes maybe not in a rational way, but the gist of it is trying to assert their own independence. Damn it. You know, I want to be independent and I'm not going to have you tell me what to do. So it's about being rationally independent, about focusing on objective truths and analyzing the nature of the system as it's set up today as being in defiance of that and wanting to actually see a different way of interacting with people that's based on voluntary principles. And that's not at all what we see in education, because at the end of the day, it's funded through coercion. Mm. What happens when parents don't pay property taxes? The guys on Free Talk Live have gone over story after story about people's houses being taken from them, which is not a good way to deal with people. And it's not a way to actually fund an educational system, is it?
No, and it also says a lot about what, not just the quality of the system, because obviously quality goes out the window when something is funded by coercion or even just subsidized by the state. But why does the state, and people are kind of confused about how the public education system actually works. Schools are mostly funded on local levels, but mostly controlled as far as what is taught, what the curriculum is, on the federal level, even though the federal government contributes a very small portion of the funding. Like you said, Wes, most of the funding for these schools comes directly from people's property taxes on a local level. But why, if I ran through this sort of business plan of a sociopath in the first episode of School Sucks podcast, where I start a tutoring business by pointing guns at people. Now, when you think about that in terms of public education, why are they willing to have such draconian punishments for people who don't want to support the system? It says a lot about how much they value this system, and by they, I don't like to use the sort of the broad conspiratorial they, but how really public education is the linchpin of keeping the state together. I know we talked about that on Complete Liberty, I think. I know throughout the series, 46 through 51, those episodes, we talked about education. Mm-hmm. But I think we really talked about how essential the system, the public school system, was to the state in episode 51. And I think that's very revealing when you think about how the drastic measures of punishment that are available to you if you as a homeowner say, I'm not going to pay for this. I'm not going to use it. And I'm not going to pitch in for other people's children to be indoctrinated, to be made obedient, predictable, and apathetic.
Yeah, and what is the typical response, right? It's so predictable. Well, this is for the common good, Brett.
Yeah.
You have to contribute. You must be part of the community. Well, why? Why is that so important, to actually force people to be part of something they don't want to be part of, or to be forced to pay for something that not only did they not want to pay for, but that is actually damaging to the people who are the recipients of that money?
Yeah.
You know, they're sacrificial fodder to the collective. And of course, this idea of public schooling, public is a euphemism too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a euphemism for something that's controlled by the government, that's funded by coercion against the public. I think maybe public is just a shortened version of what I just said. Controlled by the government, funded by the coercion against the public school.
Yes, and they strategically use words like this to make it seem as if the knife is not plunged fully into the victims, right?
Right.
And they're not twisting that knife, as you use that metaphor, because that's the nature of it. And we have to understand that when people are forced to do things against their will, in defiance of reason, in defiance of morality, in defiance of justice, you're not going to get any semblance of rationality, ethics, or justice in that process. You're going to get the exact opposite. And as far as conformity to the system goes, it really takes an independent spirit to not conform. And I really have to hand it to unschooling parents that have decided to not partake in that anymore. And I'm not sure how many of them are not paying property taxes on account of that. But no product or service should be provided at the barrel of a gun, or be imposed at the barrel of a gun. And that's essentially what happens. People are forced to do things against their will. And as long as people keep on conforming with it, the people who lust for power, the people who enjoy their positions of authority and influence, are going to keep on with what they're doing.
What I was thinking, how I was thinking we could wrap this up, was with a thought experiment where if we lived in that neighborhood or a neighborhood controlled by a violent gang, and everybody in the neighborhood talked about the gang, they did this strange linguistic programming where they, when they talked about the gang or the actions, they used words like we, us, and our. Would they become more sympathetic to the gang's activities? Would they become more resistant to the idea that the gang was doing things that were evil and immoral? And what if everybody did it? What would that mean for the legitimacy of the gang? Because I think that one of the things that concerns me the most about collectivism, like I said, is tyrants didn't come to power. They don't come to power by saying, I am going to be such an asshole, just watch. They come to power by claiming that they are there for the common good. So how do, and I think we talked about that a little bit, but how do people participate in that process?
Yeah, how do people participate in that process? I think maybe we could turn it around even and say, how do they not participate in that process? Because yeah. They already know how to participate in it, right? They're doing it full on, it seems. And the status lapdogs in the media are all about perpetuating those memes of collectivism, of those plural pronouns, we and us and them and they and us against them in terms of foreign policy and all this collectivistic rhetoric that doesn't deal with the facts as they are. It just deals with these non-concepts, if you will, these unintegrated concepts that keep us enslaved as conformists. So what does it take not to conform to that? What if people started not using those plural pronouns and started correcting people whenever they heard people utter those things? That could send ripples through the culture, could it not? And change the way people are viewing not only, you know, the societal ideas, but themselves in relation to each other. Because if we're not all part of this great big collective called America, then we're just individuals with values and virtues that interact with other people, and we have good relationships based on respect rather than being enslaved to ideas that don't honor ourselves but actually act in defiance of ourselves, that denigrate who we are and what our potential is. In other words, all these collectivistic memes are self-denying and self-defeating.
And we keep on paying those freaks on the TV who claim they will save us but want to enslave us. And sweating like demons, they scream through our speakers, but we leave the sound on cause silence is harder. And no one's the killer and no one's the martyr. The world that has made us can no longer contain us. And